This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Left of Bang, How the Marine Corps' Combat Hunter Program Can Save Your Life, by Patrick Van Horn and Jason A. Riley. Narrated by Danny Campbell. Foreword. A Day at Camp Pendleton. I first met Captain Van Horn and Major Riley, he was a captain then, when they took me through a one-day mini-version of the Combat Hunter course at Camp Pendleton in Southern California. After 3 minutes, I thought, this stuff has got to be made available to the wider public. The Combat Hunter course teaches Marines what their conventional training doesn't, not only how to deal with the bad guys, but how to spot them in the first place, particularly when they look and act exactly like the good guys. Left of Bang is not for combat warriors only. It is for you on the subway, you in a bad part of town, you with the sharks in the corporate boardroom. It's for your wife when she's home alone, or entering a dark parking structure, or walking with the kids on vacation overseas. Right of Bang, as Van Horn and Riley explain in this book, means after the bomb has gone off, after the shots have been fired, after the damage has been done. Left of Bang means before the bad stuff happens. That's where you want to be, alert, ready, prepared to respond to protect yourself and your loved ones. I'm proud to be a part of the team that is getting this material out, not just to soldiers and Marines in their training, but into the wider world that includes your family and mine. Bang happens. This book will teach you how to stay left of it. Stephen Pressfield, Los Angeles, 2014. Acknowledgements. As Malcolm Gladwell skillfully demonstrates in his book Outliers, most success stories should be understood as a combination of mutually supporting factors, two of which are hard work and opportunity. We have both put hundreds of hours into researching this material, refining and further developing course material for the Marine Corps and training Marines. Although we are nowhere near the 10,000-hour mark needed to claim expertise, our numerous deployments, experience, and research into these topics give us a unique insight into the type of behavioral analysis we are writing about. More important for both of us have been the opportunities we have been given to become a part of the Combat Hunter program in the first place, to be able to build upon the work and successes of those who came before us, and to be able to work with tremendously professional and inspiring Marines within Mobile Training Company. Because we are building off of others' works, we must take a few minutes to give credit to whom credit is due, and to thank them for what they have done. First, we wish to thank the Marines who have themselves spent hundreds of hours training Marines and developing courses. Major Dane Hansen, Major Keith Montgomery, Major Paul Chase, Gunnery Sergeant Gonzalez, Gunnery Sergeant Tollett, Staff Sergeant Moose Morris, Staff Sergeant Hammer, Staff Sergeant Baldino, Staff Sergeant Valdez, Staff Sergeant Jeru, Sergeant Arnett, Sergeant Guzman, Sergeant Sevrud, Sergeant Giles, Sergeant Gibson, and the numerous Marines who came before us. We apologize for anyone we've forgotten to include. Second, we wish to thank the civilian instructors who passed the baton to us. Greg Williams and his colleagues poured several years into developing the combat profiling program and deserve full credit for the genesis of these concepts. While we have made these concepts our own, even disagreeing at many points, and have advanced thought in numerous ways, they deserve great credit for their hard work. We also wish to thank those researchers and scientists who were generous enough to share their time and expertise with us as we conducted our research. We also wish to thank Stephen Pressfield and Sean Coyne, who believed in us and made the publication of this book possible. We would also like to thank Lisa and Angie for reading every word, listening to every rehearsal, and supporting us every step of the way. Without you, this book would never have been finished. We fully acknowledge that without these individuals, this work would not exist. Finally, we humbly thank the thousands of Marines who have deployed abroad, and who are currently deployed, ensuring the peace and freedoms we take for granted every day. Preface. Strangers in strange lands. Imagine you are a U.S. Marine or soldier patrolling the crowded marketplace of a hostile enemy village. You are separated from the nearest squad member by about 90 feet, the distance between home plate and first base at a major league ballpark. You are easily identifiable by your tan uniform, flak jacket, weapon, radio, and other gear. The enemy is unidentifiable. The enemy could be anybody. The market is crowded. People are pushing and shoving. Some are bumping into other people to avoid you. Others don't move out of your way until you invade their personal space. Others, not paying attention, bump into you. During your pre-deployment training, you are told to look out for military-age males when patrolling an urban area. But what does that mean? You've heard reports of 10-year-old children proficiently firing weapons. You've been told that the natives have been fighting for centuries, and that some of the toughest warriors in the village are old men, elders, and warlords. So military-age males include every man and boy in the village. You have also heard reports of female suicide bombers blowing themselves up in the midst of a patrol. How do you determine who is the threat? On the best day, your patrol moves through the village without incident. On a good day, you observe a weapon or suicide vest, and you are able to react before the insurgent fires at you or your comrades, or blows himself up. On a bad day, the enemy is too quick or too close for you to do anything at all. All of your training stateside focused on what to do once something happens. A bullet is fired in your direction, an improvised explosive device, IED, explodes, or a mortar round impacts nearby. You can't help but wonder how you could get a jump on the bad guy before the bang. How can you discern those who want to harm you from those who are just afraid, or just about their business before the attack? How can you defuse a threat before it happens? Is that even possible? The Combat Hunter program has proven again and again that it is. Marines and other members of the armed forces, law enforcement officers and other security personnel, and even the average person cannot wait for dangerous people to do bad things to them. Nor are contemporary environments of peril confined to foreign lands. The streets of Los Angeles, like the alleys of Kandahar, are complex and chaotic environments in which it is not always easy to tell the good guys from the bad guys. The military, law enforcement, security personnel, and even civilians can use the principles in Combat Hunter to identify three types of people in any public arena: the shepherds, good guys, sheep, regular guys, and wolves in sheep's clothing, bad guys. It's not magic. It's based on the universal patterns of human behavior. No matter the race, religion, nationality, sex, or age, people share a common physical language that can be learned and interpreted by anyone. The Combat Hunter program teaches us to do that. Paradigm Shift. Jason A. Riley. I first learned about the Combat Hunter program after I had already deployed 3 times. The phrase commonly used to describe the change in mindset after a person completes a Combat Hunter course is paradigmatic shift. After the course, you perceive the world differently. You no longer simply see footprints in the ground, but evidence of human activity. A set of footprints becomes the beginning of a track line. Before Combat Hunter, I was only partially aware of the meaning of human behavior. Like most people, I had certain intuitions about situations and other people, but I couldn't articulate them. After Combat Hunter, I had a language to describe the phenomena I witnessed and understood human behavior entirely different. Nevertheless, I was disappointed that I could reflect on 3 deployments and identify numerous times in which Combat Hunter could have aided my Marines and my ability to identify insurgents and IEDs, and more effectively conduct counterinsurgency operations. I am a suspicious person. By that I mean that I am usually suspicious of anything new and popular, and I was immediately suspicious of this program. Combat Hunter wasn't the usual tactical course. I wasn't a believer, initially. What is also a stumbling block for many people is that once a person has learned about combat tracking and combat profiling, it doesn't seem complicated. It seems obvious. Of course, footprints have outlines, edges, shapes, etc. Of course, a person stepping on rocks will displace them or leave mud on the rocks. Of course, someone will act differently if they feel uncomfortable. Any fool can tell you that, but this is like saying, "Of course the earth revolves around the sun." Combat Hunter is like a Copernican revolution of the mind. It seems obvious afterwards, but is rarely realized on one's own. Another problem is that most people can't articulate what they see, and they can't say anything about the meaning of other people's actions. They usually don't do anything about other people's behavior. What Combat Hunter, and especially Combat Profiling, does is instill a mindset of proactiveness in an individual, with the tangible skills of observation, tracking, and profiling. We've trained numerous people from outside of the military. When law enforcement agents go through our course, especially senior agents, they are consistently amazed that they were never taught these things before. Naturally, most of the senior agents tacitly know this stuff. They have years of practice of observing human behavior, and, if pressed, could probably articulate most of this stuff in one way or another. However, these agents also say that what Combat Hunter, especially Combat Profiling, provides is a lifetime's worth of experience in a few weeks. It gives Marines and law enforcement agents explicit knowledge that would have taken years to learn on the job. Now that I have been trained in the skills, have developed courses, and have trained other people, I believe that anyone who is concerned for their safety and the safety of others would do well to learn what we teach. I wish I had this before. Patrick Van Horn. I was first exposed to Combat Hunter after twice deploying to Iraq and spending another year preparing a company for its year-long deployment to Afghanistan. As I sat through that first class, I couldn't stop myself from getting angrier and angrier as each class built upon the last. When it came to preparing Marines to identify an enemy hiding amongst a civilian population, the material taught during that first 2-week Combat Hunter course made it one of the best I had seen. The instructors were discussing topics and restructuring how we looked at the world, and I was mad that my units didn't get to learn this before we deployed. The course would have had a huge impact on the way we operated overseas, the way we patrolled, and the way we talked to local villagers. This had to change. Spending the next 2 years leading a mobile training team, I began to see the underlying problem. It was one of exposure and distribution. We were only teaching about 40 Marines in a battalion of nearly 1,000, but there was no way we could ever get this to every Marine heading downrange, because it just isn't possible to provide classroom instruction to everyone. The course provided skills that might bring more Marines back alive from deployment, yet there weren't enough instructors or time to teach everyone. This had to change. This book, our website, and now my company exist to fix that very problem. No Marine or soldier should have to deploy without first learning how to find the enemy before he begins his attack. No police officer or security guard should have to go on patrol without knowing how to identify a criminal before he commits his crime. No person should have to wait until they see a gun to know that there is a threat present. Getting left of bang requires two things. The first is a mindset and mentality to actively search your area for people that don't fit in. The second is the knowledge to know what causes someone to stand out from the crowd. I hope that this book and the web pages provide you with what you need to do both. Part 1. The War Lab. 1. A Marine Called Chaos. In July 2006, at the height of the Iraqi insurgency, American service people were being killed and maimed in unprecedented numbers. In a single month, 1,666 IEDs were detonated, and another 959 were found waiting to explode. In September 2006 alone, 776 Americans were wounded. In the first week of October, 300 more were hit. In the lexicon of after-action analysis, these warriors were right of bang. They were reactive, and the enemy triggered his explosive devices before our troops were aware of the danger. To provide perspective concerning the destructive nature of an IED, consider the Bradley fighting vehicle. The Bradley is armored and heavily armed, designed to transport and provide suppressive fire for dismounted troops in an attack. Its main weapon is a 25mm cannon, which fires up to 200 rounds per minute, 3 to 4 bullets per second, at a maximum effective range of 1.5 miles. The Bradley also weighs approximately 22 tons. The Bradley is a ferociously powerful vehicle, capable of bringing significant destructive force upon the enemy. But even the Bradley is no match for an IED. In 2004, after a Bradley struck an IED in Iraq, its armored bottom plate was found more than 60 feet from the site of the explosion. One simple yet powerful IED can destroy a $3,200,000 machine in seconds. The destructive force is even greater when IEDs are strung together in what are called daisy chains, or combined with complex direct-fire ambushes. If these statistics about IEDs are not startling enough, other intelligence estimates indicated that the insurgents were actively hunting soldiers on patrol. Beginning in 2005, several videos were released by an insurgent group called the Islamic Army in Iraq that depicted an enemy sniper killing American soldiers and Marines. This individual became known as the Juba Sniper, and it is unknown how many soldiers and Marines he wounded before his capture. The figures are certainly in the double digits, perhaps even the triple digits. The effect of the videos and the targeting of troops on patrol was unnerving. The long hours of foot and vehicle patrols and standing guard made Marines and soldiers fatigued and complacent. The set patterns made their targeting easy. It was obvious to the troops on the ground that stateside training was inadequate in finding the sniper and others like him hiding in plain sight. The IEDs and the targeting of American forces by Iraqi insurgent snipers gravely threatened the entire U.S. war effort. Something had to be done. The first response from the military establishment was to increase production and employment of better body armor and heavier armored vehicles. These steps helped, but they also made U.S. Marines and soldiers clumsier, slower, and more obvious targets than before. It was a losing battle because the larger we made vehicles and the thicker we made armor, the larger and more deadly the insurgents made the IEDs. Although the addition of armor and other technologies helped protect troops from IEDs, we were only treating symptoms, not the cause. Marine General James Mattis, callsign Chaos, had a different idea. Mattis was the commander of the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, commanding all Marines in Iraq. While Mattis believed in the importance of integrating the technology, he also saw the limitations of what was then available. The technology at the time mostly provided a defensive capability, and he wanted to go on the offense. He wanted to take away the enemy's options of when and where the IED could be detonated. To make Marines more tactically cunning on the battlefield, he believed in creating not only better technology, but also better training. In fall 2006, he requested that the Marine Corps develop a program to instill a hunter-like mindset in Marines, train Marines for increased situational awareness, proactively seek threats, and have a bias for action. Mattis wanted Marines to be the predators, not the prey. This directive from Chaos was the genesis of the Combat Hunter Program. 2. Left of Bang. The Marine Corps War Fighting Lab went to work in early 2007 with the task of creating a program that gave Marines the ability to realize an attack was imminent. The preparation for an attack leaves behind cues a trained observer can pick up on to provide an early warning. Training Marines to make those observations was one of the goals of the program. In the lexicon of Combat Hunter, the purpose was to get Marines left of bang. If you were to think about an attack on a timeline, bang is in the middle. Bang is the act. Bang is the IED explosion, the sniper taking a shot, or the beginning of an ambush. Bang is what we want to prevent. Being left of bang means that a person has observed one of the pre-event indicators, one of the warning signs, that must occur earlier on the timeline for the bang to happen. In an IED attack, an insurgent would have to observe the Marine unit in the area, identify that they use the same road on their patrols, determine where on that road they would place the IED, acquire the materials, build the bomb, dig the hole, and put the IED in the hole, connect the trigger, and watch to see if the attack was successful. Being left of bang means that we can identify the people doing the surveillance or placing the IED and prevent an attack from happening by stopping the process there. Being left of bang means not letting the insurgent carry through with the plan to kill American troops. Being on the other end of the timeline is referred to as being right of bang. Most of the training that military operators and law enforcement personnel receive is reactive. They learn skills and techniques that rely on someone else taking the initiative, which means waiting for the enemy or criminal to act first. Unfortunately, whoever strikes first possesses a powerful tactical advantage. When a person is right of bang, they are reacting to the action that took place. After the IED detonates, then the Marines establish security on that site. After the IED detonates, then the Marines treat their casualties. After the IED detonates, then the unit returns fire on the enemy. Whenever a person is operating right of bang, it means that the enemy has the initiative and controls the situation. But operating left of bang requires intense concentration to identify the pre-event indicators and gain an advanced warning about the enemy's intentions. These indicators, however, are not always easy to discern. If the first time a Marine realizes a threat is present is when he sees an AK-47 assault rifle aimed in his direction, he has already lost the initiative and is now reacting to the enemy. Getting left of bang requires that he can make informed observations and build an enhanced awareness of his surroundings. 3. Cooper's Color Code. In February 2013, New Orleans police officer John Pissarro responded to a report of a robbery at a local Dollar General store. It was about 7 a.m. The information given by the dispatcher was vague. Going into the situation, Officer Pissarro was unsure if the store or an individual had been robbed. He was unsure if the assailant was still at the scene or if he had fled. He did not know if the robber was armed. When Officer Pissarro arrived at the scene, he did not see anyone in the store. Backup was on the way, but Pissarro decided to enter the store on his own anyway. As he made his way through the store, he noticed the door to the manager's office was closed. He approached the door and announced that he was a police officer. Immediately, the robber opened the door and fired on Pissarro, hitting him twice and leaving him in critical condition. The shooter fled. Thankfully, backup arrived within seconds of Officer Pissarro being shot, and his life was saved. Right now, there is insufficient information to know exactly what Pissarro's actions were at the scene. It is unknown if he had drawn his gun. Initial interviews and reports of the incident have placed some blame on the unclear, ambiguous information given the officer. Captain Michael Glasser, president of the Police Association of New Orleans, stated, "Had there been any indicator it was in progress, I'm sure he would have acted differently." There is certainly some truth to this. Better information definitely would have influenced Officer Pissarro to take different actions. If he had known that the robbery was still in progress, he most likely would have waited for backup. Raymond Burkhart III, a lawyer and spokesman for the local Fraternal Order of Police Lodge, was adamant that the way communications relayed it to Pissarro, the officer did not have accurate information to make the proper decision. This is probably true, but certainly not the only reason events unfolded as they did. In analyzing this situation through the lens of combat profiling, we want to raise the issue of awareness. In no way do we want to portray Officer Pissarro badly, and we certainly do not have enough information to criticize his actions. Regardless of what Officer Pizarro did or did not do, he is not at fault for his shooting. No one has the right to fire on a law enforcement agent, and the only one guilty in this situation is the perpetrator. Nevertheless, it is appropriate to discuss the situation to learn from it. The situation could be viewed from multiple perspectives. Tactically, perhaps Officer Pizarro could have positioned himself better, at an oblique angle from the door, or ensured he had cover before announcing himself. Our focus is the psychological perspective. What was Officer Pizarro's awareness at the scene? Was he of the mindset to respond with lethal force, even if he didn't have positive information that the robbery was still in progress? Or was he unprepared and unready to take lethal action? From the perspective of combat profiling, a basic mental preparedness to take lethal action may be the difference between life and death. Retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Cooper developed a system of awareness he called his color code that described the psychological conditions a person could have during any given situation. Cooper's color code possesses four levels of awareness: white, yellow, orange, and red. Condition white means being unprepared and unready to take lethal action. A person who is in condition white is in a low state of psychological awareness and physiological arousal. If attacked, this person will likely be the victim. This person believes his or her personal safety is not in jeopardy, and has chosen not to actively assess the surroundings for potential threats. Should a threat arise because of a lack of awareness, that person would be completely unprepared, forcing them to be reactive. Condition yellow means that the person understands that his or her life is in danger, and is therefore psychologically prepared to do something about it. This person is actively searching the surroundings to find a threat because he or she is in a moderate level of psychological awareness and physiological arousal. Once a person has recognized a threat, they have escalated to condition orange. Condition orange is the mindset in which a person is focused on a specific threat and is prepared to take action against that threat. This person is usually in a lower state of psychological awareness than in condition yellow, but in a higher state of physiological arousal. This person has begun creating a plan for how to deal with the threat. The degree of awareness a Marine has here is less than that of condition yellow, because the person's attention is now focused on a specific threat. Condition red is labeled the lethal mode. It is the psychological willingness to kill if circumstances warrant that action. Condition red includes being in the fight and executing the plans created in condition orange. This person is in a much lower state of awareness due to being focused on one specific threat and has a very high degree of physiological arousal. Because of the inherent risk of engagement in a fight, the person's awareness of the surroundings is further reduced as his or her mental capacity is focused on personal challenges to survival. Based on research by retired Lieutenant Colonel David Grossman and others, the Marine Corps has adapted Cooper's color code to describe physiological arousal and awareness levels. In the Marine Corps system, another color condition exists, condition black. Condition black is characterized by when a person's heart rate reaches a point that is counterproductive, above 175 beats per minute, and that person begins to lose awareness of the surroundings. A person in condition black can no longer cognitively process information and may completely shut down. The normal psychological state of anyone concerned about personal safety must be condition yellow. This means being aware of one's surroundings, looking for potential threats, and being alert, no matter the situation. Combat profiling rests on the assumption that being proactive, being left of bang, requires continuous awareness and alertness. It requires that the combat profiler always be psychologically prepared to take action. From this perspective, Officer Pizarro's situation can be evaluated differently. Although he may not have had accurate information about the crime in progress, that should not have mattered to him. Any police officer responding to a scene should be psychologically prepared to use deadly force if necessary. Regardless of whether one knows danger is present, one should be ready to take action and be looking for indicators of a threat. In the aftermath of the shooting, Captain Michael Glasser, the Police Association of New Orleans president, said, "You anticipate that backup is coming, and you anticipate that this is probably going to be like all the other calls." From the perspective of combat profiling, this is the opposite of what we want people to think. You should never anticipate this is probably going to be like all the other calls. Marines, police officers, and anyone who wants to survive an attack must never be caught off guard. Every situation must be considered potentially dangerous, and you must be constantly ready to take action if a threat emerges. 4. Re-engineering the toolkit. Marines, soldiers, police officers, and basically anyone who operates in a complex and potentially hostile environment must make tough decisions under severe duress, usually with little time and information. Not only must the Marine identify the enemy, but he also must consider the various rules of engagement and escalation of force measures and ensure he has positive identification, PID, on the enemy before returning fire. What many do not understand is that though these measures are supposed to facilitate decisions, to the rifleman on patrol, these measures seem constraining, hindering, and overburdening. The average Marine's head spins when trying to consider all of these factors while simultaneously keeping himself and his fellow Marines alive. Since the invasion into Afghanistan in 2001, Marines have been put into countless bad situations, and while some have made less than ideal decisions that have gotten a great deal of attention in the media, the vast majority of Marines have made great decisions and have shown incredible insight, sharpness of mind, unerring intuition, and the ability to examine a situation and know exactly what to do. Here's the problem. It's all chance. There's no way to tell from one Marine to the next who will have the keenness of intellect to make good decisions on the battlefield and who will fail. Currently, it's not entirely based on the training they receive. A Marine's ability to make decisions is mostly due to his or her life and experiences. The Marine cannot control much of this. Some Marines can quickly identify certain patterns in Afghanistan because they have, for instance, experiences staying safe in dangerous areas of New York or L.A. They have what we call thick file folders, a significant amount of relatable experiences they can quickly access in similar situations abroad. But certain Marines having these experiences is simply coincidental. They just happen to have grown up in a dangerous environment. Other Marines aren't so lucky and do not have the experiences needed to make the same decisions driven by intuition. Intuition is a powerful force. However, it is poorly understood. Intuition is not black magic or some inexplicable force of nature. Intuition is nothing more than a person's sense about a situation influenced by experience and knowledge. Intuition is the way the mind picks up on patterns and uses experiential and learned knowledge to guide a person during a given situation. However, intuition is often driven by the subconscious. It's rightly called a gut feeling, since people can literally have a physical response when their intuition tries to make them aware of something they do not consciously know. Some of the more significant studies regarding intuition have been conducted by Gary Klein, who developed the idea of recognition-primed decision-making, RPD. RPD describes how people with expertise intuitively identify a pattern in a situation and quickly determine a course of responses without any analysis or comparing different courses of action. These intuitive decisions are very often right, but they are good enough solutions, not perfect solutions. Klein and his fellow researchers conducted studies with pilots, nurses, military leaders, chess masters, firefighters, and other experts in various fields, and determined that in most cases, these experts did not deliberate when reacting to a situation. They just acted. The type of intuitive decision-making that Klein describes is best done in the types of situations that are time-constrained, high stakes, uncertain, and constantly changing. Sound familiar? These are the exact types of situations that Marines, police officers, and other security personnel experience daily. One of the key aspects of RPD is pattern recognition. The basic aspect of recognitional decision-making is that people with experience can size up a situation and judge it as familiar or typical. These individuals do it quickly. Fire ground commanders make 80% of their decisions in less than 1 minute. Medics make trauma treatment decisions in seconds. Chess masters play moves in less than 6 seconds. Consequently, those with experience growing up in tough, do-or-die neighborhoods often have great intuition about places like downtown Baghdad or Kabul. Most Marines do not have sufficiently significant life experience to make decisions like experts. They don't have the knowledge and experience base for their intuition to be completely reliable. However, by constantly being aware, Marines can proactively take action before getting caught right of bang. This is why Cooper's color code is so important. Cooper's color code allows us to quantify a Marine's state of mind and gives us a target of awareness to aim for. Unfortunately, most situations don't lead Marines into condition yellow. Rather, they push Marines directly into condition red, and sometimes even condition black. We need to be in the yellow state of mind, left of bang, to avoid the possibility of deterioration into the black state if and when there is a right of bang event. The Marine Corps War Lab endeavored to detail the qualities a Marine would need to reach and maintain a yellow state of awareness. They wanted to determine how a Marine on patrol could take on the offensive mindset of a hunter instead of the defensive mindset of prey. 5. The Experts. Throughout 2007, the Marine Corps Warfighting Laboratory leveraged the experience of many civilian and military experts to design and structure the course that would become Combat Hunter. The program was designed to take the best and most basic skills of observation, hunting, and urban know-how and combine them to increase Marines' abilities to proactively identify threats on the battlefield. 3 specific skills were identified and focused upon: enhanced observation, combat tracking, and combat profiling. Ultimately, the Marine Corps Warfighting Laboratory chose 3 experts to lead the development, expansion, and initial instruction of each of these specialties, the 3 pillars of Combat Hunter. Ivan Carter, a big game hunter from Africa, developed the observation portion of Combat Hunter. He recognized the foundation of every hunter is the ability to see his prey. He influenced the development of classes to teach effective observation techniques and how to better use both day and night optics. David Scott Donnellan, a former Rhodesian Special Forces operator, designed the combat tracking portion of Combat Hunter. Combat tracking teaches Marines how to read and understand the physical terrain and identify the physical evidence individuals leave behind as they move through an environment. This skill allows Marines to pursue an armed enemy while gathering information to determine their future actions and intent. Greg Williams, a former law enforcement officer, designed the combat profiling pillar of Combat Hunter. While combat tracking is focused on the physical terrain, profiling teaches Marines how to read the human terrain through an increased understanding of human behavior. This allows Marines to recognize the subtle aspects of human behavior to find the enemy hiding in plain clothes. The integration of these 3 skills and concepts into military operations, whether in an insurgency or in a full-scale war, creates a more intelligent warrior capable of outthinking and outmaneuvering an enemy who seeks to blend in with his environment. The goal of Combat Hunter is to teach Marines how to separate the sheep, the unarmed civilians that populate the battlefield, from the wolves in sheep's clothing, the enemy. In a war in which our enemies do not wear uniforms and blend in with and exploit the local populace, the effort to locate and isolate the enemy can be challenging. Combat Hunter aims to train Marines to face this problem head-on. 6. It Works. The Marine Corps Combat Hunter Course has trained thousands of Marines since its inception in 2007 and continues to provide Marines with the skills and the mindset to survive in the complex, chaotic environments of Afghanistan. The course is taught in various places and schools throughout the Marine Corps, but mainly the program has been geared toward training Marines before deployment. Through the hard work and dedication of the program's enlisted and officer instructors, Combat Hunter has made an invaluable impact on the Marine Corps. What have the instructors and students all come to realize? It works. Since the first Combat Hunter course was conducted in the fall of 2007, deploying forces have provided incredibly positive feedback. Four comments are typical. 1. This is the best training I've received in my entire Marine Corps career. 2. I wish this course was longer. 3. Every Marine should receive this training. And 4. I wish I had this training before I last deployed. Marines have eagerly reported that the increased awareness of both the physical and human terrain has alerted them to threats and has given them additional time to recognize the situation and take action against the enemy. As instructors, this is positive and encouraging. However, the second reality is humbling and fills us with remorse. Marines often tell us that the material they learned during Combat Hunter could have helped them when they were in combat. Often, students remembering specific events reflect on a fallen brother or sister in arms that might still be alive if they had received this training sooner. Unfortunately, not every Marine receives this training. This book on combat profiling and our training website are designed to supplement the Combat Hunter program and correct that problem. Every Marine and soldier should have this training before they deploy and must face an armed enemy. The concept of Combat Hunter is a working hypothesis, not an established science. However, we have seen this concept work in practice and continually receive feedback from Marines deployed about the effectiveness of what we teach. The program works. It has made Marines more aware of their surroundings, more survivable, and more lethal on the battlefield. Combat Hunter, and specifically combat profiling, is not solely for Marines. These concepts and lessons relate to every person who has dedicated his or her life to protecting others, soldiers, sailors, airmen, police officers, and other security personnel, or even those who simply want to remain safe as they go about their daily lives. Whether you and your family are on vacation overseas, or whether you are a woman who finds yourself alone in a dangerous environment, understanding when you or your loved ones are in potential danger can be the difference between life or death. Combat profiling is universal and applicable anywhere in the world. 7. What combat profiling is. This book is focused on the Combat Hunter's third pillar, combat profiling, a method of proactively identifying threats based on human behavior and other cues from one's surroundings. Combat profiling is a practice based on a proactive mindset that incorporates many specific skills. Four of these are situational awareness, sensitivity of baselines and anomalies, critical thinking, and decision-making. Combat profiling allows the Marine, soldier, or law enforcement officer to proactively identify threats based on human behavior. To do this, that operator must first be actively aware of his or her surroundings. The first skill this method provides is the ability to quickly develop situational awareness. To have situational awareness, you must be able to read both the environment and the people around you. However, you must also be able to separate important from unimportant information. Not everything you see is relevant for identifying threats. The second skill in combat profiling is the ability to determine what indicators are important and directly related to your safety. This means being able to pick up on both overt and subtle clues of the physical environment and people's behavior. We will discuss human behavior further below, and we'll provide detailed discussions of human behavior in the following chapters, but for now, it is sufficient to say that people's behavior betrays their intentions. By this, we mean that you can read subtle cues in a person's behavior to determine and predict what they will do. Combat profiling gives you both an in-depth understanding of human behavior and the skills to read human behavior and predict people's intentions. We will tell you what indicators to look for to identify threats, threatening behavior, and threatening environments. The third skill that combat profiling teaches is critical thinking. We are surrounded by information, ambiguity, and various factors in different situations. No two situations are exactly alike. Therefore, we teach you how to critically assess the information you collect and how to weed out the unimportant information and focus on the important. Finally, the fourth skill this method teaches is the ability to make sound snap decisions, or heuristics. Heuristics are ways of making a decision with limited time and information. Whether you are in the military or law enforcement, you will never have all the time or information you need to make the perfect decision. So you must make the best decision with what you have. Unfortunately, few people are ever taught how to make a decision. Decision-making is either something you are assumed to have learned throughout your life, or are taught as a lengthy, deliberate process. Neither of these options helps the operator on patrol. So we teach you how to make an accurate decision quickly, based on a few pieces of relevant information. 8. Proactive, not reactive. Combat profiling is, first and foremost, not racial profiling. When identifying threats, one does not focus on race, religion, or ethnicity, but on behavior within a given situation. In fact, someone who only focuses on surface, broad-based differences between humans is playing right into the hands of the enemy. The enemy has exploited those prejudices extremely effectively. Unfortunately, since 2001, most Americans, including military and law enforcement personnel, have fallen victim to Islamophobia. We constantly look for people who look like terrorists. By this, we implicitly mean young to middle-aged, Middle Eastern Muslim males. There are several problems with this. First, only a small percentage of Muslims are extremists, and only a small percentage of those individuals conduct violent acts. Second, criminals and terrorists come in all shapes, sizes, and ages, and from all races, ethnicities, and religions. They can be either male or female. The United States has suffered enough from homegrown terrorists like Timothy McVeigh that we should know not to assume a person is a terrorist because of appearance. Third, as we will discuss later regarding decision-making, by focusing on indeterminate factors such as race or ethnicity, we miss out on important behavioral indicators that are necessary in identifying threats. Additionally, when we allow our false preconceived notions and biases to give us tunnel vision, we do not see the dangerous individuals who do not fit our racial profile. Combat profiling is also not criminal, psychological, or personality profiling. These types of profiling have specific purposes and are valid and useful within the appropriate contexts. A criminal profile is a collection of inferences about the qualities of a person responsible for committing a crime or a series of crimes. That is, criminal profiling is a way of inferring the characteristics of an offender from the way that offender acted when committing the crime. Criminal profiling analyzes the evidence and patterns of a particular perpetrator to infer certain personality characteristics to assist in solving crimes. This type of profiling is synonymous with what the FBI terms criminal investigative analysis. Although combat profiling shares several qualities with criminal profiling, like inference, critical thinking, analyzing patterns, and considering an individual's or group's modus operandi, MO, the two methods differ significantly in their applications. The first and primary difference between criminal profiling and combat profiling is that criminal profiling is reactive, while combat profiling is proactive. Since we are not yet at the point of precognitively seeing future crimes, like in the movie Minority Report, criminal profiling requires that an individual commit a crime or a series of crimes to develop a profile of the perpetrator. Additionally, criminal profiling is a non-real-time, behind-the-scenes type of analysis. Unless specific evidence is available, criminal profiling cannot predict the time, location, and target of the next crime. Conversely, combat profiling is an on-the-spot method of proactively identifying and predicting a threat. It is used by individuals wherever they are in real time. While combat profiling does use information gained from previous attacks or crimes, similar to criminal profiling, the focus of combat profiling is to be proactive and prevent the event from ever occurring. Now that we have a very broad understanding of what Combat Hunter is, proactive, behavior-based data collection and analysis, and isn't, prejudicial, socially imposed categorization with no analysis beyond black or white, what are the skills Marines learn in combat profiling training? What the experts have contributed has saved scores of Marines. Part 2. Everywhere we go, there will be people. 1. The Dilemma. On November 1, 2011, Marine First Lieutenant Jeff Waddell was on duty monitoring surveillance video when he spotted a known enemy operative. This insurgent was responsible for building the bomb that wounded a Marine sergeant 2 days before. First Lieutenant Waddell, a Bronze Star recipient from his previous deployment to Afghanistan, ordered a nearby sniper team to fire on the man after receiving permission from the battalion's Combat Operations Center. After the snipers hit the insurgent, a group of Afghan males ran to the man and attempted to put him on a tractor. Seeing this, First Lieutenant Waddell ordered the sniper team to engage the tractor's engine block to disable it and prevent the man from escaping. The tractor was hit, and no civilians were injured. It wasn't until approximately 3 weeks later that it was discovered that the people who rushed out to help the wounded insurgent were teenagers. Upon this discovery, First Lieutenant Waddell's battalion commander promptly relieved him of duty for violating the rules of engagement because the snipers fired at individuals who were seemingly giving medical assistance to the wounded insurgent. Despite the positive review from a Marine Brigadier General who stated that First Lieutenant Waddell was a superb and heroic combat leader, his career was effectively stunted. Despite the fact that his quick, level-headed thinking dealt with the situation in a way that resulted in no civilian casualties, First Lieutenant Waddell was punished because of the complexity of the rules Marines must follow while overseas, the rapid pace of combat, and the difficulty of the decisions Marine leaders must make without access to complete or perfect information. There are several problems with the situations with which Marines are faced and the decisions they are forced to make. The first is that no one has ever taught Marines, or anyone really, how to make decisions, particularly quickly, with little time and information. Throughout life, people are expected to simply learn through trial and error how to make a decision. Generally, this tacit way of learning to make decisions is adequate to get most people through life. But in stressful situations such as combat, many people either freeze or make no decision, or make terrible decisions. Marines learn two lessons early on that give them a false sense of decision-making ability. BAMSIS and OODA. BAMSIS is a Marine Corps acronym for the 6 troop leading steps. Begin the planning. Arrange the reconnaissance. Make the reconnaissance. Complete the plan. Issue the order. And supervise. Unfortunately, these troop leading steps do not actually teach Marines how to make a decision. They outline a general process of developing and executing a plan. The second acronym, OODA, stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, and Act. This is also called the Boyd Decision Cycle. This process, articulated by Colonel Retired John Boyd, describes the 4 main steps that a person, group, or organization takes from observing a phenomenon to responding. This is a very helpful way to envision how people observe their surroundings, observe, make sense of what they see, orient, decide what to do, decide, and then execute what they've decided, act. However, just as BAMSIS simply tells a Marine to begin and complete a plan without teaching them how to plan, OODA states that a decision must be made without explaining how to make that decision or what Marines should be seeking to decide intelligently. 2. Paralysis by analysis. The second problem is that the decision-making methods people are taught are almost exclusively analytical, very deliberate approaches of weighing the various issues to a problem, pros and cons, costs, risks, and gains, etc., and then somehow determining the best decision. Analytical decision-making works in situations in which we need to make the best possible decision. We have sufficient time to problem-solve, plan, and deliberate options. We have sufficient information to consider all the issues. We have clear criteria to decide between options. We need to justify our decision. We need to carefully plan contingencies or alternate plans. Unfortunately, most situations Marines encounter do not allow for any analysis at all. While the analytical approach has its strengths, it also has its weaknesses. In fact, many of its strengths are often liabilities. Deliberate planning often takes too much time to conduct fully. There is often not enough information to analyze a situation or problem properly. Too much information exists without a way to determine what's most important. Clear criteria for choosing between options may not exist, or options may be similar enough that a deliberate decision is practically arbitrary. The reality is that we don't use this approach for the majority of decisions we make on a daily basis. If we did, we would never get through the day. Imagine thinking through the issues, developing multiple options, weighing the pros and cons, and determining a course of action for everything we do. We have probably all seen someone fall victim to paralysis by analysis and become unable to make a decision because of his or her need to consider every piece of information. Furthermore, even deliberate decision-making is not purely analytical in every way. It often uses intuition and heuristics. Last, just because a person uses analysis does not guarantee that the decision will work, be right, or even be good. Analysis is often wrong, and in many cases ends up with less accurate decisions than either intuition or heuristics. It isn't uncommon to think through something, only to have a gut feeling that the decision we made is not the right one. The problem for Marines is that analytical decision-making is neither practical nor useful in the high-stress situations encountered while on patrol, whether to shoot or not in a matter of milliseconds, whether to travel a particular stretch of road, whether to go on alert after passing a group of villagers. A better, quicker method of making decisions is needed. 3. Information overload. The next problem is sort of a paradox. At one and the same time, Marines are bombarded with too much information and must make decisions based on too little information. Marines operate in 360-degree, three-dimensional environments, threatened by hazards from any direction. Anyone or anything could be a threat. Any trash pile could be hiding an IED. Furthermore, Marines are often doing multiple things at once, communicating with one another, maintaining their patrol formation, and providing security by watching their sector. Some are talking with locals. Some are monitoring the radio and communicating with other units. Some are specifically looking for certain types of threats. For example, vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, VBIDs, snipers, IEDs. Meanwhile, each Marine is thinking through potential situations and attempting to determine how to react. The amount of information that Marines must try to process at any given time is overwhelming. Marines never have enough information to make a perfect decision. Local drivers often speed toward a patrol oblivious to the patrol's presence. Unfortunately, to the Marines on patrol, this looks like the action of a suicide bomber. Locals often approach patrols with requests. Marines have no way of absolutely knowing any particular individual's intentions, whether hostile or friendly. The challenge of language and cultural barriers only compound the uncertainty and difficulty of determining a person's intentions. Despite this, Marines must make a decision. Unfortunately, to wait until the speeding driver or the approaching local is definitely a threat will often be too late. Therefore, Marines must be taught a way to make decisions that ignores unimportant information while taking advantage of the little important information.